Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we'll be having a special interview episode. Kevin Jarek is back to discuss some alfalfa and other things related to our crop growing season. But with me as always is Bill Schomburg.
Hey guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Today we are welcoming back a, I believe we determined, fourth-time guest on the podcast here, Kevin Jarek. So, Kevin, welcome. Thank you for coming back.
Appreciate the invite, guys.
So, obviously, as it is football season and you are a Packers shareholder, are you happy with the way things are playing out as far as, you know, we're in year two of the Jordan Love era?
I think the big thing is when Aaron Jones left, I think people were not quite sure how Josh Jacobs was going to work out. And for the first half of the season, he got yards but could not find the end zone. And, you know, when it gets cold outside and when you have to go play outdoors, you need to be able to run the ball. And so what I like about this is that even though Jordan Love maybe hasn't had the statistical year he did the second half of last year,
yep,
the fact that they can lean on the running game, and it's a power running game, not a finesse game. We're going to run the ball. We dare you to stop us. Try if you can, Seattle.
He said he has zero bumps and bruises. Like, I heard an interview yesterday. He's like, I feel great. I have no bumps or bruises. Like, for that guy, week, whatever we're at, 15 or whatever, it's like, oh, my God, Jones would have been.
Well, and I think what compounds that is they named off a stat, and Kevin, you probably have it memorized, but he's got the most like yards, extra yards on the carry. Like he's had, they said how many carries or whatever, and most of his breaking tackles and like
yards after contact.
Yards after contact.
And so Matt LaFleur even pointed out that he always makes the first defender miss. And I think that's true. And Bill, you're right. I was going to say, I could not believe the quote. He was asked by reporters, Josh Jacobs, and he said, I feel great. When do NFL players say they feel great?
July?
Last week of December.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, nothing against Aaron Jones, but he was not, like, if he could find an opening, he could get a lot of yards. But he was not the break the tackles kind of guy. I mean, yeah, Josh Jacobs has coughed up the ball a couple times, so is Aaron Jones and some of our other running backs. So comparatively, I think I like a lot more what I'm seeing with Josh Jacobs than
the holes he seems to find are crazy. They're not holes, and they open up very briefly. So he runs at not even a spot that's open, and then it sort of just peels open just enough to fit through. It's wild when they show that view from behind now.
Spider cam,
yeah, and it is. It's pretty amazing what he can do.
But how many times do you go like he made 1 yard like where he should have lost three, or he gained 5 yards and he should have had 1 yard? Like he just finds a way to fall forward, get an extra yard or three. It's just things that smaller guys can't do.
How many times have we seen him standing upright and the team pushing the pile and moving him forward? I don't remember seeing that with Aaron Jones.
No.
Aaron Jones would get out, and he generally got himself. With this, it just seems there's a different vibe, a different approach. And I think that when you look at the Packers, when they had the best team in the league, 15-1 in 2011, the 9-7 Giants came into Lambeau and beat them. Why? Because they had a bruising back named Brandon Jacobs. They could control the clock. Everybody talks about Jeff Hafley and the defense. The defense is doing great because they're not on the field on these long drives, so the defense has time to take a look what's going on, make adjustments. So this run game doesn't just impact the offense. It is making the defense better.
And I can really appreciate the, like you were saying, Bill, Josh Jacobs is the running back we've always seen other teams have. That, you know, we've never had those guys that really just can break through, or like you said, fall forward and seem to like, oh, that was like a 1 yard run turns into six. Like
maybe Amon Green.
Amon Green.
Maybe, yeah. I'd say Amon Green. Yeah. It was probably the last one.
But we thought we had, like, Eddie Lacy, we thought he had him at, you know, certain times.
Cheeseburger Eddie.
But, yeah.
His nickname was the Hammer. Well, that was a small hammer.
Yeah, ball peen hammer.
It was like, until it's Edgar Bennett or Amon Green, you know, Dorsey Levins was great, too. But, like, I think he's starting to, Josh Jacobs is starting to get there. How happy, Kevin, were you for him when he had that receiving touchdown? Like, how cool is that? He's never
had one. He never caught one. And he had caught passes. He's a good catching running back, and they did it with the Raiders. He caught balls, but he never caught one in the end zone. So that was cool that he finally got that monkey off his back, and he really is a complete running back. There are running backs that can't catch a ball to save their life in open space. And the fact that he is not having the injury issues that everybody, all the analysts when the Packers signed him said, oh, yeah, we love the pick of safety with McKinney, but boy, the Packers really messed up, and oh, they're paying him $48 million and 4 years, and he's never going to make it that long. Boy, it sure didn't sound that way yesterday.
He's got to be loving where he is versus where he was. Like, they're literally in the number one pick slot right now is the Raiders. Like, they're the worst team in the NFL. So
Devontae left the Raiders to go to the Jets. You don't think Josh Jacobs thinks about that at night of how different his life would be? Think if Tom Brady was drafted by the Arizona Cardinals at pick 199 instead of New England. Would have his career turned out the same way? We don't know for sure, but I think that where you are as a team, and they've asked former Packer players who've played elsewhere. Oh, is Green Bay special or are other teams like this? It was Dorsey Levins years ago who said, yeah, I always wanted to play for the Giants. And when I got there, A, we had a losing season. They won maybe 3-4 games. And the atmosphere and the culture was not the same. Mm-hmm. Ask Amon Green about Houston. He went there and then came back. He said, wow, you don't appreciate what you have until you lose it or go somewhere else and it's not there. Things you take for granted. I love the team chemistry, camaraderie that we're seeing out of this group.
You talk about things that aren't there too, and they asked Josh Jacobs about living in Green Bay, and he said, like, there's nothing to do there, but I don't want to do nothing anyway, kind of a comment. So it was great.
I believe, like, the way you wanted to say that, Todd, is he said, I can focus on football.
Right.
I love football. Right. The only thing to think about here in Green Bay is football.
And that's all
there
we
aren't
do think
other
about.
Distractions.
Yeah.
Gee, there might be distractions in Las Vegas. Who knew? Huh.
He's not going to go Plaxico Burress himself because he doesn't have nowhere to do that.
Yeah, definitely no distraction in New York either. So that's
exactly.
Good. And you are right, Kevin. This team, what does it feel like to you? What other team that you've seen does it have the feel of or the makings of with that camaraderie that you're seeing?
I'm not going to pick the most recent Super Bowl winner, 2011, because it doesn't feel that way. It actually feels, it's weird because the Super Bowl in 96 was a slow burn. They went 9-7 in 92, missed the playoffs. Went 9-7 in 93, made the playoffs. 9-7 in 94. Then all of a sudden, 95, 11-5. Then 13-3 in 96. We know they won it in 96. That 96 team was special because everybody cared about one another. That's the year Brett Favre went trick-or-treating with Chimura and Bag of Donuts. Yep, Frankie Winters.
Yep. Frank Winters.
To Holmgren's house. They had fun. They actually liked the people they were around. It wasn't just going to work and then rushing in a big city to some distraction or get your mind off football. The fact that we're seeing that with this team, that's my take, is that I'm not saying they're the 96 team. I'm not saying they have that level of players, but boy, we've seen how many times the Packers were the best team or had the MVP but didn't win a Super Bowl. So maybe this is what they've been missing. And to be able to go on the road to Seattle, a place they hadn't won in 16 years, and do what they did means it doesn't matter if it's Minnesota, Detroit, or Philadelphia. If they go on the road in the playoffs, they have a chance at every stop they'll make.
They just got to keep playing. Like, I think that week off, you get, you lose your mojo for, you know, like to say it that way. But I think for these guys, if
they're not going to get it anyway.
They're not. But how many times have we had it? And it's like, well, that didn't do us any good because the other teams are hot. I mean, we're playing well going into the playoffs. I think that's where, you know, maybe Detroit didn't take the injuries out, but they're kind of, they did well. Now they're maybe coming back. And other teams, you got to peak right now.
Yes. That's the key, is that the fact that we don't have extensive injuries. Yes, Quay Walker, and there are others who are hurt, and obviously Jair has been a big absence as far as if we're going to play a team like Minnesota or someone with receivers, the Eagles, the Lions, we need him back. But at the end of the day, the fact that we have been able to get this far and still have the record we do, I don't see them doing anything in the remaining weeks to fall out of the playoffs. I think their percentage chance of being in is like 99%. So given the opponents they have on the schedule, I think all of their goals are ahead of them. And 2011 proved your seeding doesn't matter. It's how hot you are, how well everybody's playing when you get into the big dance.
All right. Well, I think we've definitely touched a good amount of Packers talk there. So now we should probably talk about the reason you're here, which was not just the Packers talk. We could probably do a whole side podcast.
I didn't get that Packers message. I thought we were just going to talk Packers all day.
No, I'm sorry, Kevin. We'll edit that out later. we probably could do a whole separate podcast on that, but we know you've had a lot of time in alfalfa research in particular. We've talked about that a little bit before we were recording today. Every year at the Outagamie County Forage Council, for as long as I can remember, you've brought up the Alfalfa Yield and Persistence Project. So how many years have you been doing that now?
So that was a team forage project that originated in 2007. So it's referred to as simply the WAYP, Wisconsin Alfalfa Yield and Persistence Project. And the idea behind it is that if you look at the NAS publications, National Ag Statistics Service, you can see pretty reliably what the grain yields were for soybeans, for corn grain, for wheat. When you look at those numbers year to year, it's like, okay, it may not be exact, but it makes sense. When you looked at the alfalfa numbers, it just did not match up with what we were seeing out on farms. So the idea was, let's develop a project in UW Extension that collects on-farm data tracking not just a single production year of alfalfa, regardless of the number of cuttings, but let's collect data on the life of the stand and to see if we can identify where that cliff is. I mean, we have people who rotate alfalfa fields by time the third year comes around. We also know there are fields out there that are 5 years or older. And so everybody has their own system, but what can we put together from measurements across the scale and actually learn about how alfalfa behaves over a long period of time?
And you've had pretty consistent, the farms have stayed consistent through this whole project, right, Kevin? Like the number and the specific farms you've been working with have been pretty consistent.
I'm really proud of the fact that no county has contributed more data to this project, whether it's by acres or number of fields, than Outagamie County. And a shout out to all of those who have helped with this. We've had Verhassel Farms, we've had Oneida Nation Farms. Tidy View Dairy has been by far the single largest contributor as far as data to this effort. And it's nice because when we talk about looking at this information, it's not coming from Arlington. It's not from 2 or 3 hours away where the soil types are different. They have 5 or 10 days more earlier in the season that they're growing. So the fact that a lot of this information is weighted to here in northeastern Wisconsin, and a shout out to my colleagues and peers, Erica Beerstrom over in Kewaunee County. She's been an active participant. Scott Royce up in Marinette, O'Connell, Shano Langlade. So it's not just me that's working with this, but I've been there from the beginning, and thanks to all the cooperating farmers and crop consultants who've helped me along the way with data collection, we have something that we can now look at and try and identify some patterns.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point. The life of a stand can vary a lot on a farm, and for some guys it's like putting down your dog when it comes time to get rid of that one hayfield. You know, they're just like, I think it's got one more year in it. But yeah, I just looking at the data set, I know you shared an article with us that was recently published in the Clippings magazine for Midwest Forage Association. It's been a pretty good yielding 17 years. I mean, overall, the numbers have been not individually consistent, but I mean, your tonnages have really held on pretty well, it looked like, across the span of this project, other than maybe a couple oddball years that are dropping below the 4 tons of dry matter per acre line there. Is that something that you think we can point to a specific reason why those 3 years stand out, or is it something that you think is more weather-related, anything else, other factors that are playing into that?
So the 2 years that stick out as the best years were 2007 and 2010. Those were good growing seasons, and so we were basically averaging 5 tons of dry matter alfalfa. When we look at the project as a whole, if you ask farmers how many tons of dry matter alfalfa they grow, you're going to have people say, oh, I remember those years. Well, I'm growing at least 5, probably 6. Yeah, I probably have some fields going 7 or 8 tons of dry matter as well. I have a great quote from one of the farm participants in this. Kevin, the scale doesn't lie. No matter if we step on a bathroom scale or you run trucks across the scale that hold alfalfa, the number is the number.
I think that actually makes farmers more disappointed than anything, because like, oh, we're doing pretty good. You know, they're just maybe scaling a load or two, or maybe they don't scale anything. They just go based on wagon loads or whatever, and then they actually go across the scale and are like, oh, crap, it isn't as good as maybe we thought we were doing.
Or the weight is good, and then they realize, oh, it's 60-some percent moisture, not 50.
Right.
And just that percentage can make a huge, huge difference. So what I would say with the project is that I think that we have high management skills being applied to the alfalfa stands here in Northeast Wisconsin. Everybody knows that when you talk about a forage, there isn't a crop you're going to grow and harvest that provides more crude protein for that dairy ration than high quality alfalfa. And as long as we manage that right, and we do so because of projects like Peak Scissors Clip, and thank you to Tilth Agronomy and to all the cooperating crop consultants with that. So
we don't mind doing it, Kevin. It's a good project.
This year that was a
long
tougher project where you're pulling out hay that's like, it looks like it's only 2 feet tall, but then you pull the rest of it up and it's like 3 feet. And yeah, you need like a hacksaw out there to cut the like tree style trunk that's on the base of the alfalfa plant.
And when you peel it up, the bottom of the plant is yellow and it has spots on the leaves that were common leaf spot or lepto leaf spot. And there is nothing you can treat to correct lepto leaf spot. So a fungicide is the old adage, an ounce of prevention, a pound of cure. You're not going to apply a pound of cure at that point. You're going to cut it. And that's how we simply manage that. But that's the nice thing about these alfalfa projects. It's not like pulling a soil sample where when you look at that soil sample, you can't look at it and say, oh, it's this many units of potassium parts per million, this many phosphorus. You can probably get a feel for the organic matter. I'm not saying you can't make a judgment, but with the alfalfa, it's not just about recording what the quality is. We're looking at the health of the stand, and we know what to do management-wise moving forward. So with the Alfalfa Yield and Persistence Project, quality is a big part of it, but we all know what drives economics in alfalfa. It's what?
Tons.
Yield.
Yep.
Dry matter yield. Mm-hmm. All of the companies are focusing on increasing yield. And that's what was missing before this project was developed, is long-term data actually showing yield across the scale for the life of the stand. So, Matt, you had brought up, are there years where we can definitely point to the weather and it having an impact? So with this project, the overall average over 17 years is 4.4 tons of dry matter. The most commonly occurring yields are between 4 tons and 4.99. So you generally are in that sphere. But in 2009, 2013, and 2020, we were significantly lower. We were down in that 3.6 tons of dry matter range as opposed to 4.5 or 5. And I think that the value of this project is you can look back at those years and say, okay, 2009 was not a particularly good growing season. It was cold. It was wet. We had a lot of corn at harvest at 40% moisture being segregated for grain. 2013, late start, cold, wet, same thing. 2020 was mixed, so you can't say completely.
But with 2020, you came off a 2018 record rainfall, and then 2019, another record rainfall, right? Like, so then it's just one of those, like, you hit the tipping point in 2020 where the cards got stacked against you, which I think is why you're wanting to talk about 2025, right? Because of what we went through in 24.
That's perfect, Bill. You actually went right where I was going with this. So let's backtrack to 2009. Even though 2009 wasn't a great growing season, do you guys remember Lake Delton? There's a place, Wisconsin Dells. There's a man-made lake. What happened to that lake in 2008?
I remember you could see the fish at the bottom of the lake.
I remember seeing the houses floating away once the area around it deteriorated and the lake burst. And so we had a lot of rainfall in 2008, and we know how much alfalfa loves a wet foot, right? Yeah, no. So we punched the alfalfa in the gut in 2008 and then said, welcome to a cold, crappy growing season in 2009. 2013 was the second year I said that was below 4 tons of dry matter. What happened in 2012, guys?
Drought.
That was a drought, yeah.
Nah.
That released in the fall. But
1988 was a drought, guys. Come on. 2012. So here are the numbers. The reason I'm being a smart aleck is in 2012, we had 23 days, according to the National Weather Service out of Green Bay, above 90 degrees. In 88, for those who can remember it, it was 34. 11 more days, wow. So 50% more days at permanent wilting point. That's why you really can tell if somebody's exaggerating, if they don't respect that. Okay, there have been droughts. 76 was a drought. There are lots of years that were drought, but 88 was the
goat.
Goat
yes. Of the droughts, huh?
Whatever the bad word for goat. What, it was a goat, but it was a bad goat. Nobody wants to.
It's a billy goat.
Grumpy goat under the bridge. But the reality is you had the plants that were under extreme stress in 2012. And what did they get welcomed in with 2013? Cold, wet, damp conditions where it never dried out. We ended up with brown root rot, and those stands just did not perform. But again, it was the year before that already stressed it. So then when we fast forward, Bill already gave the answer. What's the year before 2020? 2019. What will 2019 always be remembered as?
Ruts in the fields.
The worst growing season in a half century. I have talked to people who have 10, 15, 20 years on me. Not a single one of them has said to me, oh yeah, Kevin, there was a worst year. The closest it's come to is, yeah, there was a year in the 60s, whether it was 61 or 67, that was similar. But no one has crossed the line of saying, in 2019, guys, corn was classified as a cover crop. When right. will we ever see corn classified as a cover crop? That's how bad 2019 was. And Bill, you're right. 2018 was wet. So we literally had a three-year stretch there building to the... And 2020 was the lowest at 3.63 tons of dry matter ever recorded in the project, because it wasn't just one bad year, but two preceding it. Which brings us back to Matt's question about, well, why are we talking about this? Hello, 2025 is about to show up here in a couple weeks. And what did we just get doing out in our alfalfa fields all season long? What were the conditions when people were harvesting?
Did you not say May and June was like the wettest May and June on the last 150 Mays and Junes?
Since.
Did I not hear you say that a couple months ago?
I'm surprised you listen to anything I say. My pause and my response is like, wow, I thought I just talked to Phil Space, but the fact that you're quoting something back
between
to me,
all the pictures you show, we do listen to the words that you say, Kevin.
So, yes, I've confirmed this with Madison to make sure that I didn't misrepresent it. But since weather records began in Wisconsin back in 1895, there has never been a wetter May and June combined. That 60-day period, specifically May and June, 61 days, I guess, given Memorial Day weekend there. But long story short, we've never had a wetter period than that. So if farmers have felt like this year was different, that's because when you break history going back to the 1800s, somebody's going to feel some pain.
I'm guessing nobody alive has farmed in the 1800s. So.
I have not had anybody come up to me and say probably that, not. Kevin, I don't remember a year worse than 1895, and I could say, this year was. No, I have not met that person. They may be out there, but no contact.
So good.
So what I would say is that I am not Nostradamus. I am not going to predict the future, but if you take a look at all the compaction that these fields suffer, if you look at the cutting schedules and the fact that those were thrown off, which meant people didn't always get potash out there to replenish those, when we look at the fact that we started in March with soil moistures at 16%, people forget that we had a drought in 2023, and that drought showed up in early 2024. The alfalfa was growing actively on February 28th. You could walk out to fields, and it looked like April.
We're hauling manure then.
Right.
Yes.
We're taking soil samples.
Soil sample, yeah.
We've never, well, as long as I've been doing this, we've never soil sampled in every month of the year except for last year when we could.
More manure went out on fields on March than I can recall ever, in yes. my 25 years. Yep. In this position. Mm-hmm. Don't recall it any different. Now, I thought everybody was scared we were going to be dealing with a drought, but we know what happened. Once April showed up, okay, April showers bring May flowers. Stuff was growing in May, but then it started raining and it would not stop. And we know that kept going into June. And even July, I was out in fields in July, July 9th, it was still raining. That first week or two of July was wet. So the bottom line is we had a lot of fields that suffered crown damage. We basically dried out in late August, September, and actually had a drought going on again. So we went from one ping pong extreme to another and then back to that extreme that we were dealing with in February. Schizophrenic, anybody?
We have a name for that.
What is that?
A bookend drought.
So
it was dry to begin, really wet in the middle, and then we bookended it with another drought.
I didn't know I was going to be a part of Vocabulary Builder today, Matt. But
we're giving Matt all that credit. Yes, that's Matt's term, and he can run that to the bank.
Book and drought. I will remember.
So you
that.
Need permission from Matt to use it in any further.
Yes, there's a little TM in a circle behind it. Patent pending.
I will definitely reference that being a part of this podcast helped me with my vocabulary down the road here. But long story short, the reality is we have 17 years of data. And if you want to call it coincidence that the only years we were below 4 tons of dry matter were years where the preceding year the seeds were sown, the damage was done. The crop was basically set up to underperform because of the previous year's conditions. I think it's fair to say that farmers should be at least vigilant. They should be alert. They should be saying, okay, it was a drought towards the end of the season, but then it started raining again. Did alfalfa go into the fall here with a dry root?
No.
No. Alfalfa can actually tolerate weather extremes. If that root is dehydrated and dry, it will tolerate melt-offs. It'll tolerate 20 below. But when you have that moisture there, what happens? It freezes, ice crystals pierce the plant tissue, and now that root is going to have more damage. If somebody took a pincushion and needles and started putting those in you and it was cold, you probably wouldn't enjoy that. That's what our alfalfa plants are dealing with right now as we speak.
Do you think because of how we had to cut this last year and we have high quantity, low quality forage and in general plenty of it, that's maybe giving guys a false sense of security, like, oh, maybe I don't really need to think about seeding down. Because we've had these discussions that guys are like, oh, maybe I don't need to seed anything down next year. Hay stocks are pretty good. You think that's going to maybe bite us if we don't just keep on with the status quo?
So I think we all agree farms have plenty of alfalfa out there. I've never seen more hay for sale or gotten calls about people looking for hay here in the last 5-10 years than I did this year, because you simply had it everywhere. The quality was a problem. I think that when we look at how much milk is going to be produced by that alfalfa, people are having to use buffers and make adjustments. But yeah, it is a bit of false security, because I think back in 2016, 2017, I remember the same thing. People were calling about oats and peas and new seeding, and they couldn't get rid of it to save their lives, and it cost too much to buy a plastic bag or find additional storage. But then 2018 happened, then 2019, then 2020. I think the problem in agriculture is that everything is cyclical. And at the end of the day, if we have high forage inventories now, it's not a question of if it's going to change, it's when. And I think the damage that was done to the stands is enough that people should first be doing a forage inventory, taking a look at what they have to discern. Do I have feed that's 120, 130? Or do I actually have alfalfa that's 170, 80, 190, stuff that's fed to these lactating dairy herds? The second thing is we need to be vigilant about what's going to happen with the weather over the next couple months. If we have a real seesaw of high temps near 37, 40, and then we're going to drop to 10 below, and we don't get snow cover. I've been out in fields yesterday. The alfalfa has broken dormancy. It is growing at the base of the plant once again. Even though the winter cover is there, it did green up with some of our recent warm weather. So here we are before Christmas, and we're already broken dormancy. That plant is expending carbohydrates, so it could be more stressful further down the road.
Have you looked at the 10-day?
I have not.
40 degrees after Christmas.
Yeah, we're supposed to get rain again potentially by the end of next week.
Last year we did not have a white Christmas. We had growing alfalfa. It appears
green that, Christmas.
Yes, we're going to have a green Christmas again, because I can tell you those plants are putting out shoots. And to answer your question, Matt, in spring of 2019, because of the temperatures, when you went out to Dew Peaks' clip that year, you had alfalfa that was 11 inches, you had alfalfa that was 9 inches, you had alfalfa that was 20 inches, you had alfalfa that was 4 inches. What happened is alfalfa puts those buds for the next season's growth on in the fall. If those buds end up getting killed, then that plant has to put up new buds from the crown, and that's going to take longer. It's going to reduce yield. It's going to delay cutting. And so even if we didn't worry about the compaction, even if we didn't worry about the crown damage, just the temperature swings are enough to end up causing us some concern as it relates to those plants and how they're going to fare in the coming year.
Yeah, I distinctly remember conversations with you, Kevin, and maybe it wasn't those years, but at different times we've had that where, you know, you're trying to determine your peak stick readings and all that. And with those varying heights, you're always kind of supposed to take the tallest stem in the given area. But, you know, the years like you're describing, it's, you kind of wonder like, okay, is this still really giving me what I need because of all the variation that can be in the field? So
the one thing that actually came good, because we don't want this to all be gloom and doom, is that years ago, Dan Undersander said, one of the ways you can extend the life of an alfalfa stand is to let one cutting go to bloom. And by doing that, you're allowing that plant to replenish the carbohydrates during the growing season. It's kind of like having that weekend, Saturday or Sunday, and you don't have to be up at the same time, or you can rest a little longer. Well, giving that plant in-season rest helps. We saw a lot of alfalfa, unfortunately, that went to bloom. Not just one cutting, but two cuttings, first and second crop. So the problem is, I don't think there's a cumulative effect there.
Sure.
It works once. It's not going to bank over. And I am concerned that depending on what conditions we experience this winter, again, there's no way to predict or no way to be certain. But a smart person would be saying, okay, do I have a plan if some of the stands that I know suffered damage, I decided I wasn't rotating them. I left them and I expect them to produce the way they did last year. Okay, what are you going to thicken those stands with? Do you have some species like Italian ryegrass or other things you're going to plan to put in to make sure that you already committed to it? Or in the springtime, like you said, people are really attached to alfalfa stands. Maybe they're going to have to make the decision that it's time to get the no-till corn planter and take advantage of the nitrogen credit that's going to be there, because we're not going to get an economic yield.
Scott Newell, kind of at our fall field day, he kind of reiterated that fact of leaving a little rest for the alfalfa, right? I mean, he's been doing some research on that too that helps the persistence and yield of the stand. So it's not old data that Undersander may have. This is new, yes, you know, confirmed stuff as well.
I think that brings up a good, that's what was hard about these alfalfa fields, is we saw them get trashed in first crop, but they like came back. We saw them get trashed in second, but they looked okay again. And even going in this fall, they looked okay. You know, they weren't, you wouldn't go look at them and be like, they're the worst things ever. They remind me of the, with the Netflix fight recently and Mike Tyson. They are like the Mike Tyson that, when do you throw in the towel? Because he could still box. He could still throw punches. And he lasted sort of two rounds, maybe not even okay. And then what gave out on him, Kevin, was his legs. Like
he ran out of gas.
And like he couldn't, his upper body, he could still punch.
Yep.
It was just he had no, his whole,
there was
he couldn't,
no spring
he couldn't
in his
move.
Legs.
He couldn't back away from any punches. He couldn't. And then that was just a pathetic fight in general. So I don't necessarily want to say RFF was Mike Tyson. I'm just saying that that's a good analogy of, we don't know what we have there. We're like trying to decide when to throw in the towel on these is going to be,
we know
more
the
difficult.
Garbage is gone, right? We plowed up the garbage.
Right.
Right. There are fields that it was obvious right. that, okay, this
but
needs to go.
How are the legs on the yeah. fields we didn't plow up? Are they going to survive, or are they Mike Tyson?
And with the loss of the legs, it's not just being able to advance on the opponent or be a resilient. It's if you get hit and your legs are already wobbly underneath you. That's, I think, the analogy here with the alfalfa. It's not that the alfalfa didn't look okay in some of these fields. It's that if you take a penetrometer out there and push down, you could find select areas where it's very obvious where the tire tracks were in these fields. And not all that compaction may move away. Also, some of those crowns that were damaged, yes, they kept putting out until the end this fall. But after going through this winter, if it's going to be another 40 degrees at Christmas, that's all going to possibly impact the resilience of that stand moving forward.
Yeah, I think like you said, too, we've had 2 years in a row now of some sort of stress. I mean, last year we were surprised to see how well alfalfa lasted through the season. And then this year it was like, okay, and a totally different type of stress. Then we went into the wet stress of this year and maybe got a little bit of benefit, like you said, going to bloom and getting a little bit of a rest there, but at the same time driving across those acres when they were probably a little too wet and not really having a lot of choice in when we could do our cutting schedule. It's all kind of accumulating now that feels like a shoe's got to drop at some point.
You know, I think everybody was impressed for how dry 2023 was, that plant was still putting up new shoots in September, and the soil around it absolutely looked scorched earth as far as there was no moisture there. And so following it up with a wet year like this, it was a person had to feel incredible that the crop put up the yield it did. We couldn't do anything about the quality because we would have damaged the stands trying to take it any sooner. But yeah, this isn't crying wolf. This isn't to say, oh my gosh, people should lose sleep over this. I think it's just one of those things that when you take a look at 17 years of data and you realize, wait a minute, there's a clear pattern here, and it isn't just about the current growing year. There's a huge influence on the previous year's condition or 2 years of conditions, as Bill pointed out, with 2018 being very wet, 2019 being a terrible growing season, and then 2020, the wheels fell off. Well, 2023 drought, 2024 being very excessive moisture, and who knows what 2025 is going to bring.
Yeah, so what are some things that you know are, so say we go into next spring, we've got to pull some fields. We weren't maybe planning on seeding down as many acres as we need. What are some other things we can do potentially as another way of supplementing these alfalfa acres?
Well, I think that we've talked about alternative or complementary forages in the past, and we already touched on the fact that the first thing you want to do is not just throw the patient out because it's injured. You may want to look at thickening that stand, and you can do that with a number of grass or legume species, and so that would be the first thing. Farmers will first need to ask themselves, what do they have for alfalfa inventory, and what are they going to need for the coming growing season? And the nice thing is the article I did with MFA Clippings has a link to some tools for inventorying feeds on the farm, and so there is information there that they can use to do those assessment. The next thing is, obviously, when you look at these fields, if you had high potassium levels, that's going to make a difference. Or if you were in the optimum range and you fertilized, potassium is an antifreeze. And so the plant is going to be able to winter the weather better. Plus, when it wakes up in the spring, it's going to sure appreciate that there's a plate of food there for it immediately, as opposed to having to wait until being supplemented later on. And so I think that some of the things farmers have done, or the high producers, high level managers do, it's important to separate into the things you can control and the things you can't control. You can't control what winter months are going to bring or how conditions are going to be in the spring. What you can control is, you know what you need for an inventory for alfalfa for your farm. You know that if you have marginal fields, you should have a plan on identifying what seed you're going to plant and how you're going to thicken those stands. And then last but not least, when it comes to these, being realistic and saying, okay, economically, it does not seem that no matter what I do, this stand is going to produce. So maybe we need to rotate it to corn and take advantage of that nitrogen credit.
So as we move into 2025 with that question mark hanging above us, it's good that we have no other concerns going into 2025, right? There's nothing else we need to worry about. Everything else is perfect. We're going good.
Milk's good.
As agriculture always does, we're looking at great things. No, obviously, there's some concerns about margins and everything moving into 2025. There's always concerns about margins, but this year in particular, we're looking at some things. So what have you seen as good planning tools, not only just for the alfalfa side of things, but in general, looking at your total crop rotation moving into the next year?
So the first thing we need to do whenever we talk about economics or whole farm is recognize that since the high in 2022, we are down 25% to 30% as far as whole farm income, even with milk being where it's at. The other commodities are worth less, and so that would be the starting place, is realize we're not exactly in an ideal situation right now. So the first thing I would say is, a farm has to look at not just what's happening in the field, but we know it's all about bulk tank economics. It's always about making sure that those cows have a steady stream of high quality forage to produce milk. But when we are looking at acreage this next year, I've had grain farmers reach out to me and say, Kevin, I know my margins are going to be slim. Is there anything I can do? And the idea of having planted winter cereals and being able to sell those to a dairy producer is one of the things that's come up. Now, there are risks with that. If we have a wet spring, that means there could be lower quality feed that's harvested. It could be, result in delays as far as planting our corn silage. But if we're going to talk about economics, we can't just talk dairy. We have to look at all different types of farm. Obviously, the price of beef is good for people right now, but that could change quickly. We know that things are unpredictable. And so the idea that if we're going to take the time, Matt, do you like doing your taxes? Is that something you look forward to?
It's my favorite time of year, Kevin. Why do you ask?
Because doing a crop enterprise budget or doing anything that requires people to sit down and go through receipts and identify, here's what I had for the total for my fertilizer across this many acres. Here's what I spent for spray. Here's what I had as far as harvesting costs. I'm not sure people wake up in the morning in agriculture saying, this is why I got into this industry. This is what I love about farming. Yeah, I don't enjoy doing my taxes either. I don't know anybody that does. But in order to have the information to make the decisions that we need to, given the seriousness of where we are in agriculture, we're fortunate that milk has maintained a moderate level. It's not at the highest level we've seen. Fortunately, it's not at the lowest level we've seen. But we know that things can be fickle, and if that price moves a couple dollars in the wrong direction, it's going to join where our grain commodity markets are at right now, which is not a great place to be.
I like what you do. You got anything to spice that up that you've seen? Because most guys just don't even want to know that number, because once they know it in a very tight margin year, then you know, then deep down you know how bad it is actually. Whereas sometimes being oblivious to it completely, they actually enjoy, because I'll put it this way. I think deep down they know and they don't enjoy it, but on the outside it's like, well, no, I just get to farm and do other stuff. I don't have to worry about that. But I have seen, once they do sit down and do it, there's a sense of ease in knowing that. Have you seen any good way to simplify it, to make it where guys will do it better? Certain aspects within that budget that are actually more important than others, because there is a place, you know, there's a lever there to change where some things in your budgets are so fixed.
Yeah. So I think the expression you're looking for, I didn't come up with this, you guys didn't come up with it, but ignorance is bliss. And yep. I think, unfortunately, when we talk about society, there's more of that out there in general society than there is in agriculture, because farmers need to have at least some idea of what they're putting into the ground, given all the uncertainty and risks they face from Mother Nature and everything else. It's funny you say, is there anything I can say to spice it up? Well, the University of Illinois every year publishes crop enterprise budgets in November. And what they're doing is putting out their first forecast of what the next growing season is going to be like. When they did this in fall of 2023, the only crop that was in the black that showed any profit potential was soybeans. Now, that following spring, a few months later, all the crops went into the red. There was no black. Well, this fall when Illinois put those budgets out, we're already in the red across the board. There is nothing they're saying is going to pan out very good. So what I would say is, for my part, the University of Wisconsin Madison Division of Extension does have a crop budget analyzer tool on the Crops and Soils topic page website. And I actually am the person who is helping with some of the updating of that tool. And the idea is that when you look at it, you can at least download it and have an idea of what average numbers are. You obviously have to put your own numbers in for it to be the most meaningful and useful for your farm, but you don't sit down to a blank sheet. You can at least look at it and say, oh, I agree with that. Oh, that's way too much. I do it for this amount. So I think if you're going to take a trip of 1,000 miles, the hardest one is the first step, getting started, moving in that direction. And if you can find a tool, put it in front of you and make a commitment to actually try and identify what your numbers are, that helps. I recognize that not everybody's proficient with Excel or enjoys staring at a computer screen. So what we did this past year is we took the corn budget, the soybean budget, and the winter wheat budget, and we made them as a downloadable PDF. And that worked out really well because we had meetings where farmers pulled out their smartphones and were actually doing calculations with paper and pen and putting some numbers in. And so I think part of our job in agriculture as professionals is to find the mode of action or the mode of presentation or way to engage people in this activity, because let's face it, it's not at the top of the list as far as a priority. It's not fun for everybody, but I have seen it firsthand that when farmers actually put in their own numbers, there's a satisfaction that comes from knowing what your cost of production is.
Yeah, I think it's hard to consider yourself a business without knowing what your numbers are. I mean, obviously, if things are going really good or really bad, you have a sense of it, but it's good to know where those numbers sit, and I'm with you, too. I don't enjoy sitting down and doing taxes or any of that kind of stuff, but I do like to know where I'm at and like to know I'm on the right track. And then, too, that helps know where to cut, too. I mean, when you have an idea of where the costs are, you can really start to dive into how can I make this better? How can I improve myself and my operation?
And that's to follow up on Todd's comment. My experience has been when I put averages up and it's for land rent, yeah, people know some is higher, some is lower. When it comes to fertilizer, yeah, mine may swag a little this way or a little that way. The most contentious part, or the part that gets the most discussion, is the herbicide, your pest management, your weed control. I've got farmers who are doing stuff for less than $30 an acre. I've got farmers who are spending more than $70. And a large part of this comes down to the management of those fields. What is your weed seed bank? Do you have herbicide-resistant weeds? What is the pressure? What is your rotation? What is it you can do? And I think that's the area that if we're heading into 2025 and we know our margins are going to be extremely tight, you already have respected institutions putting out information saying, folks, this is not going to be an easy year. I think looking at the amount you're spending on your spray program makes a difference. And I think that's where having an independent professional crop consultant or someone who can look at it from an objective standpoint and isn't tied to a certain product or a certain plan, you have the flexibility to say, here's what we can do at this level, but if you're willing to, we could try this. It would give us some flexibility, and if we need to later on, we still have this in our toolbox. But those conversations need to occur. You have to broach the subject and then be willing to determine what is feasible for that particular farm.
And that makes a lot of sense, Kevin, because think about all the different management styles and types that all our farmers do with herbicide applications or any pesticide, right? They might have their own sprayer. Maybe they don't want anything to do with the sprayer, so the co-op does it. Maybe they're a large farm, so they get some bigger discounts. Maybe they're a small farm who maybe don't get the discounts the large firms do. So if you spray your own and you're large, you can cut a lot of costs because you can buy in bulk and you're not paying maybe that high of a custom application bill or that those kinds of things. So I think you're right that this year among all the other years, if you can, you need to do some shopping and not just, yeah, I'm going to go down to the local place and they've been treating me well. That's where I'm going to go. You need to do some shopping this year and figure out what is the best price.
So I've got a great lead in, and it ties to both your and Todd's alma mater, UW-Madison. And Madison, when you take a look at the farm finance programs and farm management, they have looked at decades worth of data from farms as far as individual spreadsheets, balance sheets, and profitability. My question to you two, particularly because you're alum, is Can you tell me what is the most significant factor that determines a farm profit, farm's profitability? I'm going to help you out. I'm going to give you some things here. So is it the commodity? So is it dairy, beef, grain? So is that the most important?
What you're selling.
What you're selling. Is it the size? Is it large, small, medium, 100 acres, 10,000 acres? Is it the business type? Is it sole proprietor? Is it partnership? Is it corporation? These are all different attributes and variables that are tied to farm operations. When you look at those characteristics, which one do you think stands out as being statistically significant?
Of those three?
Yes.
Ooh.
I could see all of them.
Yeah, I thought you'd have more than that.
There are other things.
No, I agree. But we don't have time But out of those three, though, you pick some. Because I'm going to go with the type, I guess. But I don't like that it, you know. But that doesn't make sense either. I don't know.
The size is hard because really big farms can not make a lot of money. And really small farms can make a lot of money.
How good of a manager you are and crop. I mean, we've seen people make money. You know, depending on the commodities. So, yeah, I'm going to go type, Kevin.
Okay. So you're going to the business type, Bill. Is it, do you agree? Is it the?
Yep, I'm going to agree.
Okay. So when Madison has looked at this and tried to say, is it the commodity? Is it the structure? Is it the size? They could not find any statistically different characteristic, meaning that a farm's profitability is not tied solely to what they grow it, how many acres they grow it on, or the type of business structure that exists. What does that allow you to conclude? Management.
Sure.
There are some farmers that work 2,000 hours a year. Most farmers work 3,000 hours. There are farmers that work 4,000 hours.
Oh, yeah.
There are so many individual characteristics that exist on any farm operation that determine its profitability. And so you can't just say that because this farm markets this, because this farm is this size, because this farm has this type of business structure, you can't point to any one of those attributes as the silver bullet or the, spend your time in this area, because if you do, this gives you the greatest potential to be profit. I'm actually proud of you guys. You critically evaluate it. Todd, you're like, well, I'll pick one, but I'm maybe 51% or 50.1%. So you know this. And Bill, you pointed out, hey, there are large farms that, just because you're large doesn't mean that you have efficiencies. There are smaller farms that maybe capture efficiencies that larger ones don't. And so isn't that the grandest thing about this largest industry in the state of Wisconsin? There isn't a set plan. There isn't a you must do this. And because there isn't a must do this, it doesn't mean it doesn't require less management. It requires more management.
Two things I've learned from this conversation. There must have been a lot of trick questions on Kevin's test at River Falls, because that was just a trick question for us.
I set you up.
And second thing is, that's why farmers are farmers, right? Because they can take the path that they want to take to feel that they're managing their farm the best that they can.
Yes.
That's what makes a farmer, in my opinion.
And that's why, even though we just had a year where we're talking about the damage to the alfalfa fields, we're looking at the economics, this is not doom and gloom, because farmers have weathered this stuff in the past and they will weather it in the future, because the best thing that farmers do is they monitor, they adjust, and they adapt. And that's what allows them to continue year after year, despite the weather, despite the markets, despite global trade, despite all the things that are out of their control. You are not penciled in that if you do this or you don't do this, that's going to determine your outcome as far as how long that farm is going to be viable. I think that's neat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The fact, and you hit it right on the head, Bill, there's a characteristic that you need to farm. You need to be stubborn. You need to be stubborn against all of the other things that are out there that if you make a really bad decision, it could impact your ability to continue. So you have to be able to be resilient. You have to be able to say, all right, I can't change the markets, but I can mitigate my risk. I can do some forward contracting. I can look at, we had opportunities in May and June with corn prices that some people did not take advantage of. And so it's okay to miss out on an opportunity, but you have to ask yourself as we approach this next year, can I afford to miss that opportunity if it presents itself again?
Well, the hardest part about farming is I don't think we go to the field going, well, I'm making a stupid, well, maybe we do sometimes, but for the most part, we don't go to the field going, well, this is stupid. I should be doing something else or I'm making a bad decision. The bad decision is found out in hindsight when we cut the hay and we wasn't expected to rain and then it does or whatever that may be, right? Like, so I think that's the hardest part is we all feel like we're trying to do our best, but we don't know that until it's too late.
And sometimes the expression is making no decision is a decision.
Yeah, 1,000%.
And here's the problem with that. If I take this advice about marketing corn last year and I go back to 2010, you were better not to market during the summer of 2010 because you got $5 a bushel at harvest. The cash price was higher than what stuff was previous. The same thing happened in 2011. You got $6 a bushel. So you had people who probably locked in less. What happened in 2012? A drought. $7 a bushel. So there is no certainty. Here's the problem. You don't always get the best outcome, even though you choose these decisions. What you're hoping is that you end up making more decisions that benefit and that the ones that don't have minimal impact or less impact than the ones you did. Mm-hmm. Nobody bats 1,000. Nobody has a perfect passer rating in football for every single football game. It can happen, but it doesn't happen every game, not for a full season. So at the end of the day, I think producers need to just cut themselves some slack and say, all right, I'm doing the best I can. Let's make sure the decisions I'm making provide upside. But in a year like this, make sure you have a high floor. Make sure the bottom doesn't fall out. Do what you need to do to protect that bottom line.
And with that, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. So, Kevin, from what I'm gathering here, we've got two assignments for folks that are listening. One is to do a forage inventory. If you're looking at your alfalfa for this next year, see what you got, what kind of quality you have, be ready for next year, and come up with a crop enterprise budget, whether it's a loan with someone like yourself from Extension, your crop consultant, whoever it is, work together, figure out where you're sitting so that as we move into 2025, we're prepared for where we may need to find that wiggle room to be persistent, to be resilient, and continue to farm into 2026.
You can't market a crop unless you know what it costs you to produce it so you know if you're profitable or not. That's the last word.
All right. Well, thank you again for coming in and talking with us again today.
Always a pleasure. Always enjoy this.
Todd and Bill, thanks, guys, for being here.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
And with that, thanks for listening. And as always, happy farming.